Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
The COVID tracking project run by The Atlantic ended, and they're taking a victory lap because they single-handedly ensured that decision makers had enough data to make data-driven decisions. This is generally complete bullshit, but we're going to talk about what actual data-driven decision-making looks like. So what is data-driven decision-making?
From the context of data in general, it's that you've asked a question, and then you've went out and sought data, and you've analyzed it or went through it, and you can make a decision based off the graph or number you got. So, I mean, that's a high-level trashy way of saying it. Really what's going on is you try to ask the right questions with a hypothesis that you know you can answer with either the data you have or the data you can go out and get. And you've designed a series of experiments called a DOE, design of experiments, or data collection that is unbiased and allows you to do things like correlation studies or most people know them as linear fits or Bayesian analysis or some way of clustering, some analysis you do on a common set of data that at the end, you're very confident has given you either a right or wrong, yes or no, this or that answer.
So let's do an example. You're in seventh grade and you have to do a shitty science experiment and you don't want to put forth any effort. So you do the, I'm going to grow a plant. And one of the plants I'm going to water with salt water and the other plant I'm going to water with water. So what's my hypothesis?
The hypothesis is going to be that the plant with regular water is going to grow better than the plant that's using salt water.
And you've based this on just a nominal understanding of salt being bad for plants, right? It's an estimate. It's a guess.
Yeah. You don't really have a lot of salt plants.
So you have this design. It's either A or B. It's a binary outcome. What's wrong with this experiment?
You already know there's a priori knowledge that salt water is toxic to non-salt water growing species of plants. You already know that. That's one. Two, you're not actually comparing, you know, any actual effect. Is it growing, yes or no, with water? I don't know, because you biased the experiment already because you're just saying, I'm going to give it water without testing anything else.
So is there actually a limit at which you can put a little bit of salt in water and the plant's just going to grow fine?
Absolutely. That is one of the major concerns about any test you do, which is, are you biased or not? So there's no actual definition here of what salt water is. Most water is salty of some sort, right? There are minerals in almost every single piece of water you get on this planet that comes from salt or some sort of hard mineral, right? You can even say limestone or something else, right? People shower in softened water, which is literally dosing the water through salt. So there are actually a limit of salt water you could drink with softened water that's not going to hurt you.
So every kid that's ever run this experiment has very likely done water with salt and water with more salt because your water softener literally has salt in it. So when you go to the tap and turn on the water, you're getting water with salt in it.
Literally. That's how it works. Yes. In this type of data-driven decision-making, in this context, is what's the decision being made here? Well, the person wants to, in this case, make the decision that salt water is bad for plants because that is the hypothesis that they're trying to solve, but it's actually already known. It's already a priori knowledge or already prior knowledge in which they know that salt water is bad, and they don't actually know at what level salt water kills the plant. They just know that if I use a lot of salt, the plant's going to die. Now, a better experiment may be that you measure the salt content and you do a gradient upwards to some level of concentration that you deem to be close to the ocean, which you could Google or find. That information is available. And you could set up an experiment of 10 or 20 plants with 10 or 20 gradients there or step changes. And then you could find the limit at which plants begin to decrease in their production value, and in which case you'd have an actual experiment and you could use data then to answer the question, is salt water bad for plants?
That seems like a lot of work for a seventh grader though. So what's an actual real life example that we could draw upon?
So the real life example that a lot of people are familiar with, you know, in modern day news or whatever, is the same idea of salt is the same idea of pollutants. Like, we have a lot of times that we have the definitions of the pollutants in the water being at some EPA level. And the argument is that if it's above this number or below this number, you have, you know, a safe or not safe, you know, drinking level. But what's missing in here is all the context that describes why that number exists. There may be things like you can't measure below a certain number, a threshold, like PFOAs. Like, literally the detection level sets the limit to what you can have in your water. There's things where long-term exposure hasn't had statistical significance in any type of negative outcome, like with MTBE or something in the water, right? Or we can't literally trace the cancer that you're getting in your neck to the water that's you know, has the fertilizer in it, but we know there's a causation there. So we're going to say it's got to be low, but we haven't actually ran the studies yet. So these are real life examples of how limits are set. The EPA sets smog limits and things like that, not because it's not necessarily, you know, good or bad for you. It's also the detectable limits. And when people begin to raise stinks, there's actually laws in Europe around the smells of chemicals. Not because the organics are necessarily regulated, it's because they don't want the neighbors to complain that you're making something in a plant somewhere. So the regulations are there saying you can't have any of this, but they don't know why. It's just there really at the threshold at which somebody can smell it.
So let's just go back to the PFOA example quick. The EPA regulates that PFOAs, which are a forever compound that was found in Teflon, is potentially hazardous to your health. And I say potentially because industry denies it. There hasn't been a super strong, oh wait, there has been a study, and it's the largest human study ever about C8 with regard to DuPont and it being found in the blood of thousands of people that had water pollution contamination. The EPA sets a limit on how much of this chemical can be found in water. And the limit is on the order of parts per trillion. So this is effectively a single drop of water in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And the EPA sets this limit not because they have some scientific study experimental data that says if you have more than a drop, it's going to cause you harm. It's a causality link that says we have a reason to believe that this substance might be hazardous. And our capacity right now is only such that we can measure things that are greater than one drop per Olympic swimming pool. So this is a measurement problem, as you alluded to. What are some other measurement-related issues?
Anything related to viral loads, and this is the hot topic right now with COVID, right? Every single thing in the world, I mean, around you, and this is the continuum mechanics, not necessarily quantum, but continuum, which means that the atomic forces are not singular atoms at some point in time. It's a continuum. It's like a drop of water. It's a virus. It's not the molecules that make up the virus. But at every single point in time, the assays that are created to quickly measure something, like let's say a viral load, can only detect a certain level. And this is true with things like, let's say, a pregnancy test. The assay is created so that if a pregnant woman pees on it during early stages in her pregnancy, when she's secreting enough hormones of a certain kind, I forgot the hormone at this point in time, it can be detected. But as the pregnancy goes on in later stages, she doesn't secrete as much, so it won't detect it later on in the pregnancy, and it won't detect it early on in the pregnancy. There's a nice sweet spot where detection is good, and you get that little blue line. But that assay has a fundamental limit, and that's why you're seeing, you know, things say, oh, 8 days sooner, 5 days sooner, 6 days, whatever those nays are, that's just basically they've been able to tailor an assay to get a better and better results at lower concentrations. The same things with the viral load. You have to have a certain amount of virus in your system to be detected, or you have to change the measurement technique. So you have to do things like, instead of just using a nasal swab, now you have to do like a distillation process or fracturing or some sort of SEM or AFM or something that will get down to that level to look for something. At that point in time, it is not scalable to the whole population. So you take a step back and say, what's the difference between the efficacy, right, and throughput? And if you can live with a certain throughput and a certain efficacy rate, then you're going to pick that assay. So you have the speed test, you have the three-day test, you have all these different tests. Three-day test is probably more accurate than the speed test. The question is, do you want to get people early on that may be infected, or do you want to wait 3 days where they can keep infecting? So, I mean, that's probably fundamentally one of the greatest discussions right now is how do you actually handle a viral load in the system, and what does that mean when it comes to data?
So going back to data-driven decision-making, let's take the pregnancy test example. We have a series of chemical tests where when a chemical is exposed to a hormone, it changes color. That's what an assay test is at its basic level. As we're designing a pregnancy test, we weigh all of these various different chemical compounds and their properties. So you might have one chemical that when exposed to a hormone in some volume like you discussed, so let's say it's like one part per drop or something. You know, there's billions of molecules within that droplet. What is the sensitivity? Okay. What is the specificity? And these are ways of saying, how accurate is the test at identifying when something occurs? And how accurate is the test at identifying when something does not occur? So it's the false positive rate, effectively. So that's something that's weighed. So you might have one molecule that's really, really sensitive, but it's only 50% accurate. You might have another chemical that's always accurate, but requires a lot more liquid. And so you would weigh, what are the pros and cons of each one of those chemical compounds, and how would they play within a product to assess whether somebody's pregnant or not? That is, at a very basic level, the engineering behind making a data-driven decision. And this plays with viral load.
Yeah, and there's something to really be said here, is that a lot of assays and a lot of tests respond to a group of hormones or a group of chemicals, or we'll call them a family. So in the case of like COVID, you know, you only want to respond to SARS to whatever the acronyms are that they keep using, because if you were to have SARS-1, you could come back as a false positive. But then it gets down to, what's the science and how do we actually go and tailor molecules to only react to, let's say, SARS-2. Now, it may be a quick change, or it may take years of development, which is too late. So then you weigh against the pros and cons of whether or not you get false positives versus false negatives. In the context of a false negative, you can go ahead and spread the disease any way you want to. In the context of a false positive, they just assume you have COVID and monitor you. So in this case, it's more of like, you know, what's the safety? And again, it's really important that everybody understands that at a fundamental level, data-driven decisions is actually more about the questions being asked and availability of data than the ability to actually make the decision. Because what you do in the beginning sets you up for the decision you're going to make at the end.
It's pure engineering in the sense that the problem you're attempting to solve has a technical solution that you can arrive at with science and math and resources, right?
Yep.
So let's take a look at another COVID-related example. The CDC put out guidelines, and we covered this in a previous episode, about the ventilation needed in schools. Joe went on an interview and he said that we got to improve ventilation in schools, and then the guidelines are literally open a window. Do you think these guidelines were done in the context of data-driven decision-making?
Not at all.
So what would that look like?
So a couple of things you can do with data, not at all. So there's a couple ways of doing this, right? We can use empirical correlations. We could try to use experimental actual testing, or we can use maybe some analytical models or you know, computational models like CFD. So in this case, somebody probably did a scaling analysis where they said, what's if there's a window open and there's a draft inside and the room is exchanging every, I don't know, 22 minutes from natural drafting, what would the viral load be inside the room? But what they didn't do, in my opinion, they probably didn't actually do a CFD, which is computational fluid dynamics, which is a way for us to computationally estimate the flow patterns, pressure, velocity fields, stresses, temperature changes, all the stuff in the room that you'd want to know with the window open. So yeah, open the room up in March, and sure, the kids will be cold, they put a coat on, and if it's windy and gusty, that's fine. But if the door is not open, there's not really a lot of air exchange. Now I open the door up, and now you have the whole room blown around, but there's no guarantee that a kid that has a viral load that's coughing doesn't have enough cough to get everybody sick in the room. They're just estimating that if it's in the air, maybe it's not. But think about in the context of a plume of cough or sneeze that you have. That plume is highly concentrated. It doesn't matter if the window's open or not. If you sneeze or cough when you have, you know, even a mask on, you're blasting viral load out to you. And even if it lands on a surface, if you touch that surface, you're going to get sick. So opening a window doesn't actually stop you from getting the peer-to-peer contact that they're saying will, I guess, be prevented by having a window open. It's completely nonsense to me.
So do you think they actually did any sort of modeling or analysis, or did they just say, well, we know that if you open a window, wind will blow in and out of the room, and that's better than nothing?
I think that's what it comes down to. It's like a nuclear bomb is coming to kill you. Hide under your desk.
We must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover! This family knows what to do, just as your own family should. They know that even a thin cloth helps protect them. Even a newspaper can save you from a bad burn. But the most important thing of all is to duck and cover yourself.
I guess is better than nothing, but what it's doing is it's placating the masses so that they send their kids back to school so that their parents can go back to work.
So if you were to do a rigorous analysis of how to improve ventilation in school, what would your experiment look like?
Well, one, you have to ask yourself, why would you even, you know...
Why would you send your kids back to school right now?
Yeah, like what's the point of sending kids back to school, right? And I guess it's a balance. You already have all this infrastructure in place, whatever. To me, this is a side point before I answer the question. In order for you to save money on capital and the inability to actually install UVC lights with circulation, you're going to make up some nonsensical statement about how you can, if you wanted to, open the window. But that to me doesn't make any sense. But, you know, again, you know, I'm just a scientist. What do I know? What the test would look like is you'd probably do one of two things. You probably would either do a full-scale spray, open the window and spray some fluoro-responsive material in dilute that you would simulate a sneeze with and see what it does.
Okay, so you would start off, you would get a room that mimics a school.
Yeah, I'd get a room mimic the school. I'd spray something in the air. I would do, what it doesn't matter what it is. You're just trying to see how long something stays in the air for. So maybe, again, you're using, particulates of some sort, dust.
Could be like dyed water in a squirt bottle.
Dyed water, yeah, but the concentrations of dyed isn't enough. So you'd probably have to do it with like an actual fluorescent material that fluoresces based on lighting, and you're probably going to light it and hit different regions of the room. And you could do all types of stuff if you wanted to. You could use a shadow graph. I mean, it's Schlieren. You could do all types of nonsense imaging techniques if you really wanted to track it all. But at the end of the day, you're just trying to understand if the room has enough draft in there. So you wouldn't even have to get to the spray. You'd have to just maybe open the window up and measure the velocity coming in of the room. And you could do something as simple as putting an anemometer in the window, right? Just spinning cups thing. You just stick it in the window and go, oh, look, it's 5 miles an hour. Or you can walk around with a pedo tube, pedo sac tube, and try to measure the flow around there, or a hot wire anemometer, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. Wander around the room, try to get velocity gradients everywhere, and just see if you can map the room. The other way of doing it is modeling and running a full-blown model and see what the velocity profiles are. What you'd really want to check for, and this is the problem with the doctors saying things like open a window, is that it doesn't account for the actual structure of the room in which you get dead zones in the corners and other areas where it just doesn't circulate. It just can't circulate there because of the viscous nature of air. I mean, it just can't.
School buildings were not designed to ventilate classrooms. It's not a primary piece of their construction. They're designed to be cheap. They're designed to be generally safe. They're made out of cinder blocks. Ventilation is old in a lot of cases. They're just not intended to be clean, air-structured rooms. Every school has a different layout, and every single room is going to be different. So this idea of a generalized average room might not apply either.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, think of most rooms. Most rooms are squares.
Or rectangles.
Or rectangles, okay? They're boxy. So right away, you automatically get dead zones in all the corners.
I was raised in a pentagon room.
Yeah, my ass. So you automatically get that. But now you also have obstructions. There's lots of things like bookshelves and other stuff in there that's going to automatically push the flow rate in a different way. Then you have stuff like a lot of places have radiators by the window. So now you're dumping heat off the window, so you're actually adding a thermal gradient upwards, potentially changing the flow up and not necessarily down to the floor where you'd want it to, mix with the students. And most schools now have dividers at desks. So you divide at your desk, you now have a fundamental block. It's like a sneeze guard at Olive Garden or a buffet place. I have no idea. I haven't been to Olive Garden in a long time.
What's an Olive Garden?
Yeah, who gives a shit? Red Lobster. Do they have buffets?
So where you grow olives?
Yeah. So at the end of the day, really what you have to do is construct 3 or 4 models, attempt to look at it. Again, these doctors don't know what they're talking about because they don't even actually truly understand what's going on. They don't understand it. They don't even understand the amount of exposure you need to actually to get sick.
And that goes back to the original hypothesis of if we were to answer the question of what is safe ventilation-wise, like what does safe actually mean?
Yeah, there's no definition of safe. There's these ideas that, if you're 3 feet apart or 6 feet apart or you don't throw shit at each other, you won't get sick. But, we don't know yet if it's long-term exposure, if it's acute exposure, if it's chronic exposure. We don't know what levels it has to be at, right? Acute with a high load versus, chronic over a short period of time. We don't know if it has to be a direct contact, like you hug or kiss or someone spits on your face, just to talk. I'm not saying like physically spit, but, you know, big droplets. We don't know if it's little droplets. We don't know if it's inhalation. We don't know if it's long-term on your tongue. You have to swallow it down your throat.
Does your latitude matter?
Does your latitude, yeah, your latitude matter? Yeah, you don't know if it's a mucous membrane transmission. You don't, you know, so when I say things like if you have to inhale it, one is when you inhale, it goes right into your lungs. The other, if you swallow it, goes and lines your throat. We don't know which one actually causes worse symptoms. You don't know that. So you don't know, you know, if you need to block inhalation or block licking your dirty ass fingers.
And in that case, you should drink salt water more often, right?
Drink salt, gargle all day long. In fact, gargling, there's nasal rinse and there's throat rinses that are supposed to cut down on COVID. So why don't you just give the kids that during the day? That actually may be a better solution than opening a window.
So we should have seventh graders doing the experiment of, do I get COVID when I drink salt water and not drink salt water?
Absolutely. It'd be better than what the Biden administration is doing with Fauci. They should have fired that man.
He has worked every day the last year.
Yeah, I haven't had a day off in over a year. And that's not hyperbole. That's just true.
He didn't work for the first 25 years of his career.
Wow. Who says he's worked ever?
You know, at some level, and this is true for every major organization, and some of you may be at different points of your career, different levels, or don't even know what I'm talking about yet, but there's a point in time in which your management structure, depending on where you're at in your company, can't even practice anymore. They just say things that they think they remember someone saying from a long time ago, and they'll just keep repeating that mantra because that's the only thing they know, and that's what Fauci is. If you gave Fauci the ability to run his own lab or go work on patients, he wouldn't know what to do.
He is a danger to himself and others.
Yeah, he literally is a position that should be rotated amongst top doctors and not just a career politician or a career, you know,
scientist.
I guess he's a scientist. He's a scientist. I have no idea. It doesn't matter. But, you know, a lot of these key positions, A, they can be politicized, and we get that. But B, people should be rotated in and out. You should rotate those positions almost like a guest lecturer or an esteemed professorship or something, right? You don't want the same person advising. Maybe you'd want the administrative part, the person who just, you know, cashes the checks and does all the stuff like the administrative tasks running it, being the same person. But really the scientist part of it needs to be rotated in and out because you really need somebody who is studied. You know, it's hard to keep up on academic journals when you're in meetings all day talking about, you know, what color font or what color pictures that we need to make the next, you know, handout to be.
So has Fauci ever participated in data-driven decision-making on COVID, or has it all been political?
It's all been nonsense bullshit. I think it's all damage control.
And I don't think he's politically competent.
Not at all. I think if you listen to some of the experts, you'd hear things like, give everybody one shot. Don't worry about the second shot.
Yep.
Get as many people the first shot as possible, because that at least will cut down on 50%+ of the infection rate amongst everybody, which then decreases your ability to have, I'm not sure what the deadly disease will be next, the variants. So right now, 100% of the population can get sick, right? Allegedly. Now, there's a percentage that already had it, so exclude them, but 100% of the people who haven't already had COVID can get sick, and a lot of people can already get reemergence of it or re-sick from it. Everybody gets a shot, 60% efficacy rate, boom. Now only 40% of those can be sick. And what you've now done is at least decrease the vectors of infection. Then what you can do is worry about second shots, or at least have the mask mandates to reduce this virus to nothing. The longer it stays out in the wild, the longer it stays in everybody's body, and the longer it can have variants form, the longer we have to fight COVID. Because at some point in time, there's going to be the fastest growing virus, just like the fastest growing wavelength. The fastest growing virus in this model will be the variant that can infect. It won't be the variant that dies off. It'll be the one that's infectious. And we'll be right back to where we were before.
So if we're going to design an experiment and our goal is to eliminate COVID, what's our hypothesis? Because the U.S. isn't making a hypothesis and they're not making data-driven decisions to fulfill any hypothesis. They're effectively just doing nothing. We're declaring it's over and it's over.
Yes, for me, the data would be clustered into a few different buckets that I think would be really helpful to know right now. So the hypothesis would go around, do masks make a difference? Do the vaccines make a difference? Does social distancing make a difference, right?
Yep.
All the things we say that are supposed to be out there and doing, that's it. Now, we already have the data we need. We already see all these stupid fucking reports from news people saying Republican governors in their states have the highest COVID you know, blah, 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 transmission rates or infections, disease. We already have lots of data. You could literally divide it on probably, I don't know, like Democrat versus Republican governorships and states and get enough data out there. You can look from country to country and what they're doing. You could look from region to region. You have all the data. It's just setting the boundaries to what that data is. Do we have areas where we had strict mask enforcement? Yes or no? Yes, you go over here. No, you go over here. Do you live in an area that has school cancellations? Yes or no? Boom, boom, boom. Do you live in an area where school is back 50% time? Yes or no? Or are you living in an area where school is back 100% time? Boom, boom, boom. You have the literal buckets of data you need to that you can go through and see what those decisions could be. So if you came back and it says, look, if you wear a mask and you socially distance and you close down schools and you close down restaurants, guess what? Transmission rates go down. If you ban public outings and actually arrested people for doing it, then you could shut it down. If you made the police wear masks instead of being a, you know, pigs that they are, you know, not enforcing laws, if you made them enforce the laws, then you would have people trespass continuously and restaurants shut down. So those type of data-driven decisions are there. It's not the ones about, well, who had the most vaccines and do we have, you know, what's the death rate amongst the elderly if they have, you know, do we give them a vaccine? You know, they have no actual goal here for their experiments. The design of an experiment, the questions you ask are tailored in a way that gets you to where you want to make a decision. I mean, that's why you have these people to ask the questions for you. But if it's basically just like, well, what do we do, Joe, to get our numbers up? How do we make ourselves more popular? And how do we get the economy back roaring? That's a different outcome than if you said, how do we keep the entire country safe and reduce the amount of deaths? Because we know those two are like diametrically opposed because we know what the answer is. So what they do is they've been playing these games with what's the number of people vaccinated? Well, once everybody gets to 25% vaccination, we can send people back to school, which is all nonsense. They keep changing the goalposts. They want to appear like they're making a difference when really at the end of the day, it's just platitude. There's nothing there. They're not doing anything.
So if you were to sample all of the COVID data in all of the U.S., which allegedly The Atlantic did, you could literally just select buckets of they wore masks, they social distance. You don't even have to organically come up with public health policy. You can assign 12 variables or something, literally extract data from the entire nation and go, what combination of these 12 variables resulted in the lowest number of deaths or hospitalizations or anything like that? But like, we are not doing that at all because the goal is political, not efficacy or reducing deaths or having COVID go away or anything in the public interest. It's how do we get Pfizer more money for having a third round of vaccines?
So there are three, I think, competing and almost, I don't want to call them Venn diagram, but overlapping things here. There is how do you get the economy back and roaring, which has the political implications, right? It's got social economic implications. People are out of jobs, the economy shits because we're a 7% service industry, 10% manufacturing, 20% governmental jobs. Like those are real numbers. I'm estimating a little bit, but that's basically what it breaks down to be. How do we get the 70% back in their jobs? Well, great. That's one bucket. The next is how do we actually eradicate this disease? All right, so it doesn't happen again. And then the other is how do we keep people safe from dying? But all three of these have different time periods and different points in which there's a problem. Eradicating the virus doesn't mean you're going to just slam into everybody as many vaccines as you can to try to stop it. It means actually creating the vaccine that works. That's one, right? It's a different time scale than trying to get people back to work. But you can't get people back to work without them suffering because you're going to get them back when the virus isn't all the way dead yet. And you're going to have this ebb and flow. And we had it in one of our podcasts, I think early on, which is the ebb and flow of the media cycle, which means it goes up, it goes down. Oh, viruses are going down. So let's go back to work. Oh, viruses are going back up. Let's go back home, which is a very unstable place to be. If you want a stable economy, right, with people being able to predict the future, which is why economies are stable, you don't do what we're doing now, which is just willy-nilly let states send people back to work. It's basically a centralized planning. You're going to stay home. You're wearing a mask. So, you know, we always talk in the show what to do locally, you know, how to fight back. Unfortunately, again, national issue, you don't have much power at the national level. You do have the power at the local level. There is the ability for you to minimize going out, minimize contact with people, and always wear a mask. Wash your hands, right? Be the champion of cleanliness and the champion of mask wearing, because that's the only way for all of us to end this.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.